30 degrees in Kenosha, 33 for Burlington, Elkhorn, Lake Geneva, and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Now 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we have an interview which features a guest over the telephone. There are brief moments in the interview when the technical quality becomes poor, but those are just very brief pockets of interference. And otherwise, the interview is very easy to hear and very much worth listening to. So we trust that you'll be patient, and we appreciate that. In part two of today's program, some thoughts on how we can sleep better. Stay with us. And we welcome you to Thursday's morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're talking theater for this portion of the program. First of all, with Brian Gill, who has been on the morning show before. He is assistant professor of performance with the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We welcome you back.
Thank you, Greg. Good to see you.
Good to have you here. And via the telephone, I'm really pleased that we can speak with a playwright by the name of Marie Kohler, co-founder of the Renaissance Theater Works, and she is responsible for what sounds like a remarkable play that opens tomorrow night at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, a play called Midnight and Mole Flanders. And we're going to be speaking with Marie Kohler about the process of crafting this play from a novel by Daniel Defoe, and what it has been like to participate in the preparation of this production at Parkside, which opens tomorrow night. So, Marie Kohler, we're great, very, very happy to have you with us on the morning show. Thank you for making time for this conversation.
Oh, thank you for letting me talk. I always enjoy that. It's theater.
Talk away. We're happy to have you, Ed. Before we start talking about this specific play, I wonder if you could say a word about the Renaissance Theater Works, which has been around for a while, but especially for the sake of any of our listeners who aren't aware of what Renaissance is all about. Please tell them about it.
Absolutely. It's as if it's my additional child. We, four other theater women in Milwaukee, co-founded Renaissance in 1993. We were a mix of skills, director, business person, couple actors thrown in there. I was not really yet a playwright. And we recognized that in Milwaukee at that period of time, and it's still somewhat true today, there were very few opportunities for women in the professional theater world. There were no female producers. There were not very many plays produced by women with roles for women telling women's stories. So we wanted to make those opportunities happen. And so the five of us got together over my kitchen table and started the process. And 25 years later, it's going strong. I am have been for quite a while playwright in residence at Renaissance Theater Works. We would take turns in producing the show for a three-show season. I would produce one, and one of the others would do the others subsequently. So it was kind of collaborative in wearing different hats, fundraising, grant writing, directing, playwriting. And we created a good number of opportunities for women and men. It's not an exclusive organization by any means. We are by women for everyone. So it's a kind of an unusual company, and it's now a theater of long standing in Milwaukee, quite respected and successful. And as I say, it's like another one of my children.
Wonderful.
In
yes.
terms of my life story.
Right. I know you have children and grandchildren, and I believe you're married to a professional actor.
I am. My husband, Brian Monty, is a core company member at American Players Theater in Spring Green, APT. Theater's kind of in the family genes at this point.
At what point in your life did you first begin seriously aspiring to be a playwright? Was that the first sort of siren call that drew you to theater, or were you first intrigued by theater in terms of other ways to be part of it?
No, playwriting was a fair ways down the list of the things that called me in my siren call to theater, or its call to me. I was an actor. I'm still an equity actor. I still have my equity card that I pay lovingly every year, even though I don't perform much anymore. I grew up in Kohler, Wisconsin, which is near Sheboygan. My mother was a very devoted community theater board member and performer herself, and so she took me to all those Sheboygan community theater plays when I was a little girl, and took me assiduously down to Milwaukee to see the Skylight and the Milwaukee Rep and further. And so I would look up at those people on stage and just think, oh, what a life. I think probably all actors began that way. And then I formed a drama club in high school and performed in college. And then when my ex-husband, who was head of the Skylight Theater, and I moved to Milwaukee to start our family. I raised kids for 10 years and then got a call. Someone had lost somebody. The Theater Tesseract had lost someone for the role of Betty in Cloud Nine, Carol Churchill's Cloud Nine. And would I like to step in? And I thought, I can't. That's insane. Yes, I'll do it.
It's insane. I'll do it. Yes.
It's insane. I'll do it. I had two little girls. Well, Brian knows what this is like because he's got two boys. But it's really, really hard to have a normal family life and be in theater. But I've sort of been trying to do that ever since. And it's a hard balance to strike. But so acting, to answer your question, acting was my first siren call. Then I got involved with these other women and co-founded Renaissance with them. And then in 1992, I was asked by a woman named Jane Mandel to adapt a play. It was a novel called A Girl of the Limberlost. And she asked me to adapt that for her theater company, which was called Next Generation Theater. And that was the beginning. And then after that, I wrote for Renaissance, and now I'm sort of writing on my own. It's a long story.
No, that's a great story. Had you seriously studied the craft of playwriting as part of your theatrical studies?
No, I wish I had. Every play I do, it's like its own little master class. I have learned by doing, and I'm still learning, as Brian Gill can attest, and his students at Parkside can attest. I'm still fiddling with lines, or I'm actually restraining myself now. It's too late. But I think, now, what makes that line work and that one not work? What is it? Is it too many words? Is it not sufficiently emotionally driven? It's always an unfolding mystery what makes a play work, I think. And I do think I've gotten better at it over the years. But no, I never took a class.
Hmm. You have been involved in this production, in the preparation of this production, Brian tells me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that typical? I mean, is it often that when somebody does one of your plays that you are on hand? I mean, is this maybe something
you're known for
doing?
It's something I'm known for doing, for better or for worse. It's not something that's typical of most playwrights. I would not say, except if it's the first production of a piece, then you really have to have the playwright there because everything is so unshaped and finding its way. So for a premiere, absolutely. After a premiere, not so common, but many playwrights do, and you'll find two versions of the same play. Like with Mamet, you'll find the first published version of a script, and then, oh my God, there's another one. He did that after he did his second production in London or whatever. So, although it's not common, it's not unheard of.
Right. And it's obviously something that you very much enjoy doing. I mean, it sounds like you take delight.
I do very much enjoy doing. This is the second time this play has been produced. It's had a number of readings, but this will be its second full production. And that, for a playwright, is the hardest thing to get. It's very hard to get a first production, but it's even harder to get a second production of a premiere play because theaters like The Splash and the notoriety that comes with the words world premiere or Wisconsin premiere. And once they've had that, it's kind of used up its sex appeal. And when you get a second production, that's when you can really get in there and figure out what could make this really better. What could make it have legs for the future? What could make it sing? And so I'm really, really grateful to Brian, who has been my mentor at UW Parkside. And the Parkside staff, theater people there, have just been really embracing of me and my work and giving me the opportunity to give it another airing, to send it on its way.
For those of you just joining us, we have with us on the telephone for this portion of the morning show playwright Marie Kohler, and her play Midnight and Mole Flanders is opening tomorrow night at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And with us in the studio is Brian Gill from Parkside's theater faculty, who is the director of this production. Before we dig into the rather salty story of Midnight and Mole Flanders, I want to ask you, Marie Kohler, about something that I read on your website when we bring up the link to this specific play. It says right under the introduction about how it's based on this 18th century novel of Daniel Defoe. And then it says, flexible casting, 10 to 18 actors, diversity welcome. Can you just untangle those words for us? Why those words are there? Why it is important for you to say that about this play?
Well, it is a big play. As Brian often says, this is big, Marie Kohler. This is big. It is. It is big, and it sort of has to be big to tell the story. It has so many. It's first novel, one of the first novels ever written in the English language. So it goes on, and it's kind of a life story, really, with many characters and many settings. And to capture that, you need a lot of actors. Brian has honed it down to 13, correct, Brian?
Yeah, yep.
And I really don't, I do say 10 to 18, but I think that 13 is really the unless you're going to be triple four, you know, quadruple casting.
I don't know how you could do it at 10.
I don't know. I probably have to adjust that website narrative. So you can shrink it or expand it depending on your number of available actors. And it's a play that's really, really ripe for universities or theater festivals, which have a large number of actors on hand. Most theater companies these days like small plays because of their budget. So for someone like a university like Parkside, it's ready-made for giving opportunities to many, many, many people. So that's why the expanse in size. And as for diversity, it tells a story of a woman who makes her way up, not just the social ladder, but the survival ladder. And that story can be told with through the story of any culture, any race. So that's kind of the backstory of that theater lingo that you were quoting.
Right. I'm anxious for us to chew on this particular plot, which, of course, is outlined in this novel from 1722 by Daniel Defoe, probably most famous for his novel Robinson Crusoe. Before we talk specifically, can we talk just generally about the challenge of taking a novel and transforming it into a play? I think the typical person hearing that would probably imagine it to not be that big a deal. I think anybody who has actually done it, as you have, understands that it's actually a very, very complicated process, and one that probably doesn't always end successfully.
You're right. It's a very much harder process than it sounds. You think, oh, it's all stories written, no big deal, just transfer it to the stage. But the theater is all about conflict. And you have to, when out of the conflict is clear. In a novel, you have, well, think how much time to read a novel. It can be weeks. It can be months. It gobbles up a lot of time. On the stage, you have 2 hours, probably tops, in the theater experience. In the old days, people took more, but these days, audiences don't like to sit that long, so you have to boil it down and winnow it out and find the through line figure out what the strongest in a novel. You probably have several themes going in a play. You can't afford to waste your gasoline on too many, or it loses its punch. So it's very hard. That's what I want to do. Story and expand it instead of a novel and shrink it. Hmm. Completely different challenges.
Right.
I was in love with this story and this woman's voice, and so I knew from the moment I read it that I found it theatrical. And when I started writing plays, this was high on my list.
Hmm. Was it your idea to take this novel and transform it into a play?
Yes, it was my crazy, wonderful idea. And the Renaissance women just stood there and supported me, which was quite remarkable.
Wow.
And now I've got Parkside.
So, Brian Gill, what intrigued you? What prompted you to choose this play for Parkside's season?
Well, we had done a reading of it. We'd done a reading of it 2 years ago. As part of our Fresh Ink series,
right,
which was, I mean, I wanted to present the play, but it was also completely self-serving because it meant that Marie and I could play, and I could get her to Parkside for a while, and I was struck with how much the play resonated. 2 years ago, and resonates even more in regards to issues of sexual inequality and class inequality. And I'm always drawn to stories that deal with shades of gray, as opposed to this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, this is the good person, this is the bad person. And because I'm always interested in, I mean, as comforting as a black and white world is, I like the stories that explain why people are doing what they're doing, especially if there's good reason. Mm. And Defoe's character of Moll Flanders is a absolute survivalist, and that really struck me. And so that was the story that I was interested in. There was a time period where the story went from being about this young woman doing whatever she needed to do to survive. Kind of it shifted into Marie and I were kind of laughingly refer to it as, you know, heaving bosoms and swishing petticoats, kind of hyper romance, you know, where Moll became this good time girl that, you know, was doing all of these inappropriate things. And that was far less appealing to me than this fascinating character that Defoe created, who just took on head-on all of these social issues that were going on at the time, and unfortunately are still going on.
Right. We haven't yet said that the title character is a woman who is in prison, and I believe sentenced to be hung.
Yeah.
And so I believe that is right around the corner for her. Marie Kohler, tell us more about this woman, Moll Flanders, and what kind of misdeeds have landed her in prison.
We're gonna go over the half hour time.
Yeah, maybe the short list.
She did a lot of stuff, and most of it was just to get by. But I think her technical crimes when she was charged with hanging were mainly pickpocketing, stealing and pickpocketing. She was considered the queen of thieves in London, and she's based on a true outlaw character, Moll King. Was that the name, Brian?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. anyone who knows or seen opera or Threepenny Opera or not Threepenny, Beggar's Opera, or has studied the literature of the 19th and 18th century in London knows that London was just roiling with a criminal underworld because people want to do things and people want to survive. People want to put food on their table. And if there's no outlet for them, no legitimate outlet for them, they'll go underground. And that's what she did. Being a woman on her own, and very talented and very beautiful, she was able to get by her wits and her cunning. She saved herself from a number of disastrous situations, and she did it by illegitimate means. She married often and well, and sometimes not so well, and she resorted at her wit's end, she resorted to pickpocketing and then became very good at it and became hardened. And so that is kind of what the play is about, is what turns one from the survival mode into hardened, spiritually hardened. And how do you turn that around in someone's life? That's certainly something that we see in our society today. And many people turn to crime in order to get by. And then sometimes when they don't need to get by, they stick with it. And so what is that? And why is that? And why is our society set up that way? And so the play explores how that inequality works and what it can do to somebody, what it can do to an individual. I suppose it's like The Wire of 18th century. All these talented, bright, gifted people who didn't have legitimate outlets, found illegitimate outlets. But in this story, there's a happy ending, which I won't completely divulge. But she manages to get by with some help. And but what I love about her is that her spirit never flags. She's always bustling. She's always industrious. She's always entrepreneurial. She's a real capitalist, actually. And she just needed the right outlet in order to do her work. Mm. And once she gets that, she rises right to the top, along with all the other successful capitalists in her era.
Right. Brian, explain the framework within which Moll Flanders is talking about herself and talking about her life in this play?
Well, she is, as you said, she gets caught and she's thrown into Newgate, which was arguably the worst prison, at least in England. And she is visited by a Puritan preacher, a young guy who has taken it on himself to save her soul. And through this conflict between the two of them, we revisit her experiences and her adventures and misadventures. So that kind of, those scenes kind of, not kind of, those scenes swirl around her and the preacher. So it's this wonderful level of theatricality where they are literally moving through and watching the memories of her experiences unfold around them
as they play out before us on,
exactly,
on the stage.
Exactly. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it jumps from, you know, the first scene is in Virginia, the colony of Virginia, and the second scene is in Newgate, and the third scene is in London, and I mean it jumps all over the place. So it's wonderfully theatrical.
Wow, Marie Kohler. The thing that's interesting,
yes,
to me is when someone writes something, in a sense, for themselves. I mean, you wrote this for the Renaissance Theater Works for them to,
uh-huh,
produce. And it's just kind of interesting to think about a scenario in which you are crafting something that will be so challenging.
Yes.
And I could see how a playwright in that circumstance might be tempted to do just the opposite, to write a play that's, in a sense, very lean and focused and
mm-hmm,
technically simple, not presenting the challenges that this play does. So in a sense, like you did that to yourself, and these women you speak of so highly, I mean, created this wonderful play, but one that is not, it doesn't sound like, easy to produce.
Exactly. It's kind of old-fashioned in that way, in that it calls for a large cast and a big budget, and a lot of technical support, scenic support, mainly costumes, although the set here, which Jody Sikas has designed and created with the help of his students, is just beautiful. It was kind of crazy, but very, very satisfying. And a lot of people are very touched by this story, because it's not one that's often told. And that, as Brian says, it does continue to have contemporary resonance. I wish I could write simple, lean plays, but I don't seem to do that. I'm always interested in history, and I'm often interested in literature and layering, the layering of texts. So it's kind of cinematic and it's kind of historical. This one is very sweeping, and there's also lovely dance in it. Brian has choreographed it with a couple of fights, which are just fantastic. Some women take the lead in some of the brawls, and it's just great fun.
Mm. It sounds like an absolutely tremendous opportunity for everybody involved. Brian, what kind of opportunity has this represented for your young students at Parkside?
Yeah, I mean, as Marie says, they're kind of doing a little bit of everything. It's been a really great example of ensemble. Parkside Theater is based.
Sure.
Yeah, and it's been great that, I mean, Marie's been a part of that ensemble, which has been fantastic. Parkside Theater is based on a company model, meaning that we function as as many professional theater companies. So it's very much an attitude of ensemble and the greater good and the bigger picture, and how when everyone pulls together, things are it sounds corny, but you know, you can accomplish great things. So the cast bought into the ensemble very quickly. The crew, the technicians, everybody really bought in, and So that was really exciting. But it's because the play is so sweeping and takes place over so many different places, I early on started to think, you know, that the transitions would be a great ally to the storytelling. So as Marie said, when we there's a dance that occurs when we suddenly are brought to the wicked city of Bath, and we were able to bring in an alum named Hannah Shea Anderson to come in, and she choreographed this beautiful group dance. I'm a stage fighter, so any chance I get to have that in a play, I will take. But so there was a tavern scene in which a highwayman gets recognized, and I thought, well, that's easy. I'm gonna put a fight in there. But as Marie says, you know, it's it's the ladies in the cast that throw most of the punches, which is a lot of fun, and
it's very fun.
Also keeps keeps the story, I think, in mind of strong women that aren't going to put up with any nonsense. And it's about time.
Right. Marie Kohler, what has it been like for you to see this play undertaken by a college, and I assume by a company of actors younger than those who presented this the first time it was done? Or am I incorrect about that?
No, you are correct about that. The first time it was done, it was Renaissance. It was a collaboration between Renaissance and UWM's professional theater training program. So there were a lot of students, but they were graduate students, conservatory students, and a few, just a couple of professional actors from the community. My husband, Brian, was in it. Brian Monty played the preacher, and the late tremendously gifted Laurie Birmingham was the mature Moll Flanders, and Emma Bates, who's now in L.A. and doing a theater, doing film work, did the young Moll. Actually, a lot of those people have gone on to enormous careers, but I have to say that I find this group of people equally talented and if not more, and the spirit in the room is just unsurpassed. It's collegial, it's enthusiastic, it's fun, it's light, it's warm, and I have to say that I think Brian is largely responsible for that, setting this tone. That they're just great kids, and they are having the times of their lives. They are doing a lot of hard work. The two largest roles, I guess three largest roles, the preacher, Moll, and young Moll, have a lot of lines. A lot! And they shifted up until last week. And they are just doing yeoman's work. I have not seen any signs of faintness of heart, or overwhelm, or oh my God, I can't do this. No scenes, no diva fits. They've all just plugged away, and they've enjoyed it, and they're good.
Well, and Cole Conrad, who's playing the preacher, is also playing the old preacher. So he's got double duty, and
double duty.
Yeah,
right.
and Christine Laskowski. Christine, she's gonna kill me. Christiane Laskowski. sorry, is Moll in prison, and she is steering us beautifully through all of the memories, and watching the younger version of herself, played by Jennifer Nelson, taking part in all of these adventures and misadventures.
Very good.
They're doing very good jobs, quite professional. It's very inspiring, and gets rid of cynical places in your soul to see young people in love with theater and enjoying it so much. It's great. It's really great.
I'm curious, Marie Kohler, you, I know, have been revising lines, and I know now you're under orders not to do so anymore with on the eve of the opening.
Self-imposed.
Oh, okay, there you go. All right. But I'm just curious.
But Brian agrees, I'm sure, that what he found is sufficient.
Right. I'm curious, what, in general, what are the, what are the nature of the kind of changes you've made? The, that is, you know, when you are tweaking a line or changing a line, typically, why are you doing that? What is typically behind those kind of revisions in lines?
That is a great question, Greg. And if I could absolutely understand that, I could absolutely understand what makes a good play, how to write a good play. But it has to do with connectedness and meaning. And sometimes you don't know that until you hear it in an actor's mouth. What is dross? What is extra? What is excess? Sometimes you want that excess just to... there's a character in the play called the Draper who goes on and on and is very lavish and excessive. And you want to indicate that with his language, but you don't want to do it so much that the audience begins to disconnect from the, what the character wants. So you have to pay really a strong attention to a word that you use, the leanness of the intent of the character with the language used. And that it's the right word. So in this show, I have mainly trimmed, sometimes connected up. As I've improved in my playwriting, I think I've realized that less is more. Especially, you know, in this show, when we've got one young man playing two roles, the old preacher and the young preacher, we found, both Brian and I found, that there was duplication that was not needed and that was kind of weighing too heavily. So that was an obvious place to cut. But so I think it's connectedness and meaning. Trim away what has no meaning.
Well, it is exciting to think about all that this represents for the young people who are part of this, and for you as a playwright to have this second mounting of your wonderful play. And, Brian, I understand that this is happening in Parkside's Black Box Theater.
Yes, indeed.
Which is such a cool space.
I love that space. Yeah, this is my third? Yeah, third time directing? I think that's right. Fourth time directing. This is several times I have directed in that space, and I just love it. It's a great, great theater space.
So tell our listeners what opportunities they have to see Moll Flanders.
So they have an opportunity on November 30th, December 1st, 7th, and 8th at 7 p.m., and then December 2nd and December 9th at 2 p.m.
Very good. And if they want ticket information, what do they do?
They can call the box office at 262-595-2564, or they can go online at boxoffice@uwp.edu.
And again, the play is Midnight and Moll Flanders, based on the novel of Daniel Defoe. And the play is the work of Wisconsin playwright Marie Kohler. And the production directed by Brian Gill. Brian Gill, Marie Kohler, what a pleasure it's been to speak with both of you about this exciting project. Thank you so much, and best wishes to the cast and crew of Midnight and Moll Flanders.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
And we're approaching 11 minutes before 9 o'clock on WGTD. This is the Thursday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out, a few thoughts about sleep and sleeping well. With Kat Duff, the author of a fascinating book called The Secret Life of Sleep, published by Atria Books. In this book, among other things, Kat Duff explains how, in fact, when we appear to be lying in bed, sleeping and doing absolutely nothing, in fact, there's all kinds of things that are going on.
Lots goes on in our sleep. We keep thinking and feeling and going over things in our sleep. We practice our skills. We remember things. We weigh variables. We solve problems. Have you ever had the experience of being bothered by something when you go to bed and you wake up the next morning and you get in the shower and all of a sudden it dawns on you, oh, this is what I need to do? That's because your sleep has been working on it and figuring it out. So they do relate very much to each other, but they have this kind of invisible line between them.
Mm-hmm. I remember that from, I think, the 11th chapter of your book, Knitting Up the Reveled Sleeve of Care, Emotional Restoration, when you tell us that that we are beginning to understand the role that sleep and dreams play in what you describe as managing the emotions that often get the better of us by day. Do we understand the mechanism by which that restoration or process of kind of making sense of things, how that happens when we sleep, when we dream? What's going on?
We're learning more. We don't understand it all, of course. But part of what we do in our dreaming lives, and by the way, even people who don't remember dreams still dream, that's been pretty well established, is that we kind of reiterate the issues that are bothering us and kind of dramatize them in different ways in order to scale down the upset, in a sense. I think that's why the Irish say, you know, a good laugh and a long sleep are the best cures. Or it's also said the best bridge between despair and hope is a good night's sleep. How exactly we make that shift from being overwhelmed and discouraged and despairing at night and waking up the next morning and ready to take on the day involves both the dreaming sleep where we go over the things that are bothering us, but also that deep sleep where we let it all go and we kind of empty out. And I think it's the combination of the two that really does the trick.
Mm. Of course, there are all kinds of people who have all kinds of difficulty with sleep, with falling asleep, with remaining asleep, and it seems like these are numbers which are escalating. One of the most curious phenomena, of course, is the fear of falling asleep. You give us a couple of different names for that, hypnophobia or somnophobia. It's such an intriguing, and I'm sure for the people who suffer from it, very, very troubling condition. What do we know about this curious experience of those who are actually fearful of falling asleep? What is going on there?
Well, it's kind of a hypervigilance. You know how if we're walking down a dark street at night, we have all our antennae out to see, you know, what's lurking in the shadows, if there's any danger around. We're hyper alert, we're hyper vigilant. Some people, their nervous systems have a hard time letting go of that hypervigilance. And I have a couple of friends who are like this, who are chronic insomniacs. They get close to sleep and then something suddenly wakes them up. Wait a minute, what if this or that is going on? What do I have to listen to? It may be carried over from times in our evolution or our history when we lived in more dangerous times, when more was afoot that we had to watch out for, or it may be a function of being overstimulated in our world. Now we have, you know, lights and sounds and TVs and everything is blaring, it seems. And it could also be a function of when people have been left alone to cry as babies too often, what can happen is that their nervous systems get extra sensitive to stress and extra taut, and then they may grow up to be people who can't fall asleep or stay asleep.
One really intriguing thing in your book is when you talk about the booming sleep industry, and in particular how sleeping pills are such an important, profitable part of the pharmaceutical industry. And yet, you tell us very persuasive evidence that indicates that, in fact, most sleeping medication, sleep aids, do almost nothing to actually help people sleep. Tell us more about what these studies show.
Yeah, it's remarkable. One in four Americans take a sleep medication every night. And what the studies show is that on average, sleeping pills give us an extra 11 minutes of sleep. What they do is they usually shorten the time it takes to fall asleep, so there's less time for that anxiety and that sleep dread to build up. But more importantly, what they do is they lower anxiety, so we just feel less worried about whether we're going to get enough sleep or not. And we don't remember our nights when we wake up in the morning, so it feels like we're more rested when actually we just got 11 more minutes. And in fact, most sleeping pills will actually shorten the time we spend in dream sleep and in the deep sleep that is so physically regenerating. So chronic use of sleeping pills will actually accelerate our aging because we don't spend as much time in that deep regenerating sleep.
Interesting. And it's so interesting. You tell us about these results, and then you write, I can hear my friends who take Ambien nightly protest that it is not true, insisting they sleep more and do better the next day with the drug. But you tell us lab studies consistently report that people think they get more sleep when they take medication than they actually do. In other words, people do not generally do all that good a job of assessing their own sleep and, in particular, how their sleep has been positively or adversely affected by something.
That's true, because, of course, we don't remember our sleep. An interesting study has come out since I wrote the book demonstrating that if someone is told they had a good sleep, they actually do much better that day and perform much better as if they did have a better sleep, even if they didn't. So there's a certain value in that placebo effect of thinking that you got better sleep than you did, but of course it's limited.
Hmm. Well, and when I underwent my sleep study, one of the things that was difficult for me was to answer all the preliminary questions about typically how a night of sleep unfolds for me. And then when I had that first sleep study and awoke the next morning, it was very difficult for me to answer those questions, such as how many times did you wake up? How long were you up? I mean, how long did you deeply sleep? Did you dream? I realized that those were all questions that were really hard for me to answer. And of course, that circles us right back to one of the first points we made in this interview, that the study of sleep is very, very difficult. And it probably always will be.
I think you're right. Stanley Korn, who was one of the wrote the earliest books about sleep, told this great story. He said that he had a really bad night of sleep. He was awake all night. In the morning, he was telling his wife when she woke up, "Oh, I never slept. It was terrible." And then they noticed there was dust on the bed, and he looked up, and the ceiling had cracked, and plaster had fallen onto the bed. They had slept through the earthquake in San Francisco, and he thought he had never slept. So our perceptions oftentimes of our sleep, insomniacs saying that I didn't sleep a wink, or people saying I slept great the whole night, are sometimes off from what really happened.
Right. I mean, those electrodes attached to your temples, those don't lie. But
no,
they sometimes paint a picture that's really hard for us to understand. Well, for much more information about the mysterious experience of sleep and its undeniable benefits, we can turn to your book, again titled The Secret Life of Sleep. It's published by Atria Books, the author, Kat Duff. Kat Duff, thank you so much. I was intrigued by your book on so many levels, and I know many people will find a lot to drink in and ponder. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, a very intriguing book indeed, titled Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner. It is Michael Hebb's contention, he's the author, that we need to find better ways to talk about the sometimes touchy and difficult topic of death. And he suggests doing so in concerted, intentional fashion over dinner. And he talks about that in this book called Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner. And we'll air that in